Broadcasting live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.com. Good morning and welcome to The Main Course, hosted by Patrick Martins on HeritageRadioNetwork.com every Sunday at noon. Today's show is actually a pre-recorded interview that Patrick had with Michelle Nishan, the founder and CEO of Wholesome Wave. It's a great conversation, so stay right here and we're going to play it after the break. Today's program was brought to you by Hearst Ranch, the nation's largest single-source supplier of free-range, all-natural, grass-fed, and grass-finished beef. Since 1865, the Hearst family has raised cattle on the rich, sustainable native grasslands of the Central California coast. The result is beef with extraordinary flavor that's as memorable and natural as the surrounding landscape. For more information, visit www.hearstranch.com.
Well, welcome everybody to this special dispatch of the Heritage Radio Network. Jack, would you call it a dispatch?
I have no mic, but yes.
Oh my God, Jack has no mic.
But he did say yes.
He can say yes. He just has to get off his chair, run to the door, open the door, yell his answer, and then run back and tag. So, Jack, how are you doing? Just kidding. We're really honored to have Michelle Nishan, who is a titan of the food world. And he has just been named the guest editor of foodrepublic.com, which is, Chef Marcus Samuelson's kind of food and lifestyle website. And he's going to oversee the politics section of this website. And I've been hearing a lot about it. And it's a real honor that you would come in and spend a few minutes talking with us about it. So welcome, Michelle.
Well, Patrick, it's always an honor to be here. You guys just broadcast the greatest things. And to have your support is really meaningful. And it's good to see you.
Well, I know one thing. My mom is listening for sure. She's one listener for sure. But we've been doing really well on the radio site. We have like 400,000 listeners a month, and this is certainly to whichever percentage of those listeners are listening right now or who will listen later. You know, this is very important causes that Michelle takes up. So you're the CEO, president, and founder of Wholesome Wave, and the owner of The Dressing Room, a homegrown restaurant in Westport, Connecticut, which you opened with Paul Newman, right?
Correct, yeah.
And so the two of you started a great restaurant. It's right tucked into the back of a little theater, right? There's a performance space there.
The Westport Country Playhouse, where Oklahoma was born and My Fair Lady was born. Great place, historic theater.
Well, tell me, how did you come to become, editor, to oversee the politics section of the food and lifestyle website?
Well, I what's really interesting, Patrick, is I think more and more chefs now, really over the last decade especially, have really been taking causes more to heart. When you're feeding people, and so many people, and you really have any enlightenment whatsoever, you realize that your choices and your purchasing choices make a huge difference, and that also a lot of folks look to you for the types of decisions that you make and other things that are important to you rather than just ingredients. So much so that even Food and Wine today is launching their first ever issue where they have 10 chefs changing the world. So it has a variety of chefs in there on this that work on the subject. So Marcus started Food Republic a while back, and it's been, as you say, a really great lifestyle website and blog. And they really felt and were getting feedback from their constituents saying, hey, let's get to the meat of some of the matters. And, mm-hmm. and they've decided to launch this kind of political section of the website that's going to look to food issues and social issues around food and stuff like that. So
now, would you call it journalism, or would you call it kind of op-ed?
No, I think it's a bit of journalism. I mean, these guys are doing it. It's a combo. I'm pretty impressed with how deeply they've dug into reaching out and interviewing a lot of folks that we recommended that they speak to on these issues, they've interviewed and spoken with Shelley Pingree, who's a congresswoman from Maine who sits on the House Ag Committee, and Kevin Concannon, they're interviewing, I think, today, who's the undersecretary in charge of food and nutrition services at the USDA. And these are folks who really are working to make positive change in the food system so that all Americans can have access to the type of foods that you and I believe in.
Now, are you able to take certain liberties because it's a lifestyle website and not like the New York Times or the Post or the Wall Street Journal? Are you able to say certain things in your work that might not be allowed to be said regularly in a...
What's interesting about the online forum is you really can pretty much say what you want. So we always try to be a little bit careful. What I found in interviewing with these guys is they, every once in a while, I have a propensity to cuss, and a couple of cuss words made it in there. I'm like, hey, can we take those out?
Yeah. So,
you know, it's always different when you're sitting with an official or you're sitting in your restaurant being interviewed by a fellow foodie, you know, but it's neat because it's a little bit on the raw side, which I think is terrific. It's reality.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we're going to talk about this in a second. There's a how to help component. So how will this week that you're spending doing this help, you know, change things? I mean, what is your short-term and long-term vision with the power of this publication?
Well, I think it all comes down to awareness. And I think it's something that you guys have done so well here with the radio network. Those listeners that you've amassed are people who want information about these issues and a variety of issues. Food is such an important, critical thing. So I just think that the power in this particular tool is that you can raise a lot of awareness and give some really good quality information for people to come to that they might not be able to find elsewhere. I also think that the food community at large, the dining community, more and more folks who do go out to restaurants and have that affordable income to make better food choices are interested in figuring out ways to make that possible for other people.
Well, tell us about a couple of the stories that readers could look forward to, you know, learning about issues, you know, in the coming week.
Well, you know, some of the stuff we're going to talk about is the piece they did with Shelley Pingree, Congresswoman Pingree, was on the farm bill, which is one of many political opportunities for us to really change the way food is priced, you know, you know, an opportunity to make healthier food choices more affordable.
Who's making off? I mean, what injustice is happening? Who's making off with the money? Like, why isn't it cheaper? Is it middlemen? Is it big slaughterhouses? Misguided aspect?
Well, yeah, it's interesting. The notion is,
who's to blame?
Well, there has been for some period of time this incredible drive I don't think it was an evil empire thing, and I talked about that a little bit on the initial posting on Food Republic yesterday. When we started the whole industrial revolution of food and the processing that made food capable of lasting for 10 years, we weren't aware of the potentially deleterious health impacts that highly processed carbohydrates would have. So there was this opportunity to say, wow, we can make food last 10 years. We can stockpile food. We can feed the world. We can save the world. It started as a positive thing. But now that we know the truth about what these highly processed foods can do to human health, as well as the processing to environmental health, knowing the truths and continuing down the path might not be the best idea. So the fact that it stays in place, and a lot of the unfair advantages that have been given to these processed foods that make them so inexpensive, direct agricultural subsidies, transportation subsidies, tax credits for opening confinement operations and food processing facilities in communities to create jobs, give those products an unfair price advantage in the marketplace, which is why you can buy highly processed snack foods, fast foods, much less expensively than you can buy fresh fruits and vegetables, which is something we should be eating 5 servings a day of.
Now, so you're already working very hard on this with your work with farmers markets throughout the country, right? You have a whole system where people can bring in a card and end up getting discounts on certain products. Am I saying that right?
That's correct. What we do, Patrick, is we make electronic benefits transfer available at farmers markets as the first step that we take so that people on federal food assistance, like food stamps, which are now known as SNAP benefits, Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, and WIC benefits for women, infants, and children living at the poverty level, so that they can come to the market and use those benefits. And when they use those benefits, we provide private funding to double the value of those benefits to make fresh, locally grown fruits and vegetables more competitive with highly processed foods. Mm-hmm. And we collect data in 30 states that shows that there absolutely is demand. People bring their benefits. They take advantage of the doubling. And interestingly, when the doubling goes away, they continue to come to the farmers markets and spend their benefits. Mm-hmm. So it's changing purchasing patterns. And it's interesting because we don't, just to be clear, We're not working to eliminate agricultural subsidies. What we're working to do is look at money that exists in the system through marketing dollars in a variety of programs that are designed to get people to either sign up for food assistance benefits or marketing the benefits. There's a lot of money in the system that could be used to help people make healthier food choices mm-hmm. that result in an immediate food choice, like an incentive to double the price of fresh fruits and vegetables. So there's money that's already in the system that we think can be repurposed that could cause a pretty significant shift towards healthier eating.
And one of your greatest colleagues in this work is Gus Schumacher.
Yes.
And that's you're lucky you get a real inside view on the realities of the politics behind all of this, because wasn't he the assistant secretary of agriculture under the Clinton administration?
Yeah, he was the third highest. He was the undersecretary of food and foreign agricultural services.
Does that mean music was played whenever he would walk into a big room, or you have to be the top to guy?
What I understood, though, is that he always brought people tulips for whatever. Gus was an amazing guy. In fact, he would have been the secretary of agriculture if Gore would have one. So we often introduce Gus as Gus was once the next Secretary of Agriculture.
He was.
States.
He should have been it. Oh,
yeah.
Man.
But anyway, the interesting thing about Gus then is that he has all that access. Here's a guy who could have gone into a very expensive lobbying position, which many former undersecretaries do and public officials. And rather than doing that, he stayed with trying to improve the lot of small-scale and mid-sized struggling farmers, as well as people in underserved communities who want access to fresh, healthier foods but can't afford them, immigrant, refugee communities, et cetera. So here's a guy who could be making millions right now, and he's not.
Yeah.
He really is not. He's working with us to get this type of change done. And he has that trust in Washington where he can get us a place at the table where we're not lobbying.
For sure. Wow, that's really, really interesting. Yeah, because lobby's a dirty game often. But I actually interviewed Michael Pollan a couple weeks ago, and he said something great. I was like, well, we actually asked a radio host to submit questions, and one of the questions is, can, small-scale agriculture, organic farming feed the world? And his answer was, well, the current system isn't feeding the world. So, neither one is doing it.
Well,
so.
I actually have an interesting, and forgive me if the statistics aren't exact, but they're very, very, very close. I read a piece about a year ago. I was the host on a show called The Victory Garden, and a fan sent this to me, and it was a piece of data from the USDA that back in 1949, almost half of the food consumed in the United States, fresh food, was consumed from Victory Gardens. Mm. So these are community gardens. In 1949, we were at half the population we were now. So if those gardens were still in production, 25% of the fresh food we would be consuming in the United States would be grown by the individuals consuming the food.
What a lost opportunity. So we let them just go up. I mean, they
went out of business. It became more convenient you know, to buy from supermarkets and grocery stores and all of that jazz. So it just eventually shifted to, you know, why have people grow their own and eat their own when we can have them spend money into the economy by buying, which is fine. I mean, that's great. But I think when you can really look at the impact of people actually taking on some self-reliance and growing their own food and supporting the school garden movements and supporting community garden efforts and cities getting more on board by really loosening restrictions or allowing long-term low-cost lease for community gardens so people have that opportunity, there's a combination of providing for yourself and spending money in the free market economy. There's nothing wrong with self-reliance.
Absolutely not.
It was almost at scale.
Anne and I just, I was gifted by her parents, my favorite show from childhood, all the CDs of Little House on the Prairie. And we watched, talk about self-reliance. I mean, A, it's a true story. I mean, probably some exaggerations, but those kids, they left the big woods in Wisconsin and he drove for months and they found a spot in Kansas and he just built a house from nothing. And the cold was there and he hunted for all of his food. I mean, it took him 2 years before he could even afford a plow or a year. I mean, you know, things have changed a lot, but I am all for some self-reliance. Well, jumping to the complete opposite end of the spectrum, give us of the top 10 sustainable restaurants in the United States, the one that would surprise us the most on that list.
Oh, holy cow. I'm not prepared for that one, but there are so many. So one that will really surprise you is Mia Sushi in New Haven, Connecticut.
All right.
Bun Lai, the chef and the owner, is a wonderful, wonderful man, and he's been doing sustainable sushi for years. And one of the ways that he addresses sustainable sushi is to go after invasive species like lionfish.
Lionfish, I was going to say.
Yeah, Asian shore crabs, zebra mussels, jellyfish. It's unbelievable.
It's agro, eye for an eye.
Yeah, he's a really great guy, but he's off the radar because he's in New Haven.
Yeah.
And, you know, he was just invited last year, finally, to Monterey Bay Aquarium as an ambassador for sustainable seafood. Terrific, terrific place. Delicious. He makes his own chili pepper, white pine, and sumac sakis. Really terrific. But there are just so many. One of my longtime favorites that just doesn't get enough attention, I think, is Henrietta's Table in the Charles Hotel in Cambridge. Peter Davis, a good friend, has been buying locally, organically, sustainably, and seasonally for 25 years. Mm. I mean, there are some folks that have been in the movement for a long time that just never got on the radar, did the PR, but that's a terrific, terrific place, and the food is always just sensational. Everybody I send there thanks me.
Well, that's good, because oftentimes the deliciousness does not follow the mission.
Yeah,
I always joke, I don't know if Chez Panisse is on your list, but Alice, I'd be like, someone would be with Alice Waters and say, oh, it was like food from the hippie movement, and she was like, please, those are very different things. Hippies were not great gastronomes. Some of them might have been.
They were eating organically because they didn't believe in eating any chemicals that didn't get them high.
Yeah.
So, you know, a carrot could be 8 weeks old. If it was organic, it was preferred. So,
on a final question, this how to help section, I always find that to be the most lacking section of anything ever all the time, you know, in this world. So I really admire you for putting that component in. And how do you vet the companies that you promote, and tell us just about what people can do and that side of the site?
How to help
at home, you know, if they live in Phoenix or, you know, Alaska.
No, absolutely. Well, you know, interestingly, I think one of the best ways that people can help, especially when you look at the Southwest, it's interesting because we've heard the term food deserts, but there are such things also as advocacy deserts. There are certain places in America that we haven't been able to go with Wholesome Wave because there isn't the community support for the types of grassroots organizations that actually reach out into underserved communities and help people that are at or below the poverty level be able to access better choices for food, education, other services. So if you're living in an area where you know there are folks that are less fortunate than you are, and there aren't organizations dealing with that, getting your community together around those things aren't a bad idea. So, you know, you have organizations like Slow Food USA now, I think, have conviviums in every city. And Josh Viertel, the new president, has really been moving them in a direction of using the power of their conviviums to activate volunteer forces and try to fill some of the gaps where there are advocacy deserts. You know, not being afraid to support big guys that are making small sustainable change also. You know, it's interesting. A lot of my friends are often a little taken aback when I say, I'm not freaked out by Walmart saying that they want to go more local. I'm not freaked out by Walmart saying they want to go organic. I'm cautious about it. There's no question about that. But my feelings are that if you get someone who is starting to put $1 billion to $2 billion a year into their foundation to deal with food access issues, they're trying to make organic and local more affordable, saying that they're not going to use the same practices by making the producers charge less. You got to watch it and keep an eye on it. And if they're true to it and they're doing it well, I think that's a win in the notch. My bottom line with these large companies moving in this direction, when you have someone like Walmart saying local is important, it tells us that the demand is so broad and across so many different socioeconomic barriers that the demand for local is even more than we'll ever understand.
Now, what about, does McDonald's go too far with their farmer ads now? You know, the scene opens with the guy driving through his...
I haven't seen these guys, you know, personally do anything yet that I can stand up and applaud.
But Walmart, you can. So it's interesting. Yeah. So there's a good and bad.
Yeah, well, there's a farmer ad, but are they buying from farmers? I don't know enough about it to comment deeply on it. But it certainly isn't on my radar screen, where I know that Walmart... their stated mission, and they had achieved it, was to buy around 7% of their fresh food from within 150 to 200 miles of their regional redistribution warehouse. They want to double that within the next 18 months. They clearly have cracked the organic code. And you can have a conversation with Gary Hirschberg, and he'll tell you what it's meant for the expansion and the support for, because Organic Valley, family farm-owned dairy co-op, it feeds Stonyfield a lot of their milk, and they've been able to increase the number of organic farmers that are owners in the co-op to be able to meet the supply as a result of Walmart being a customer. So there are some positive things there. I would love to see McDonald's do something the same or similar and really reach out to some of these producers who are paying living wages or are farmer-owned co-ops and making a difference in their lives. You know, it's interesting because I've seen a number of these large corporations put the name farmer on the label of stuff to imply as though it's coming fresh from a farm. And I'm just not seeing or hearing anything from anyone in the field that would indicate that it's true.
Now, we have a common friend who sadly passed before his time, Michael Batterbury.
Oh, yeah.
And he was very good friends with the CEO of, what was it, Cisco? Am I saying that right?
Rick Schneider.
Rick Schneider.
And he also was a founding board member of Wholesome Wave as well.
Right. So he was ahead of his time. How has that company moved forward? Now, I know they've moved forward, but if they move forward to the degree they have, give us a kind of report card of
They're still in the process of dipping their toe in the water. My understanding is most of what they've done is by acquisition. So they just
bought the company.
Yeah, exactly. So I applaud them for trying. They are trying. They're working hard on it. They're spending money to try to figure it out. But other than some acquisitions, I haven't quite seen it enough yet. Yeah, they bought a company called Fowler and Hunting in Connecticut and turned it into a division that I think they call Freshpoint. Fowler and Hunting used to buy from a lot of the producers in Connecticut and then sell to Connecticut institutions like Yale. So that was one of their attempts, but they keep morphing it more back into their corporate model. And
it's so funny. The least favorite aspect of Heritage Radio Network for him are my personal musings. But I will say Brian Kenny, who is the Hearst Ranch farm manager, he calls himself an XL cowboy. He said a great thing to me. He said, it remained a first draft turns something from an idea into reality.
Right.
It's just that first draft. And it's amazing to me, like a big company like Cisco with the profits that they must generate each year, that the they're a strategic organization, very big, like the Army or university. It's amazing that they can't within their, you know, orbit just say, hey, these four guys are running a solo operation within ours, still under our, you know, we're still overseeing it, but tactics are not part of strategic organizations. Like, they're just big moving hulking things, and sometimes I think they could benefit from eight young guys just being like, let's do something in Cleveland.
Well, you
and
know,
prove, you know, that it works.
I agree with you, Patrick. And I think
such it's a small investment.
I think it's time for an alternative model. You know, Rick Schneider's really did try to move the organization in that direction.
No, and that's what Michael said too.
He is no longer with them.
Right.
My feeling is this, and it's a real difficulty, and I know I'm going to probably upset some people saying this.
You're going to lose your 1%.
I'm going to lose. Yeah. I'm going to lose my 1%. Anyway, it's the role of shareholders. You know, Cisco's CEOs, their executive vice president, their leadership team can really want to go in a direction and say, let's have some wholly owned subsidiaries. Let's have some departments. But, you know, there's a shareholder expectation for return. And unfortunately, with resources like fuel and water becoming more expensive, pressure to eliminate and reduce subsidies becoming more prevalent, just the cost of resources, the only way you can continue the types of returns that shareholders expect to stay in your stock is to drive down cost of goods and cost of labor. Mm. So it's why these Leviathan companies generally have really questionable practices on both. So when you look at that, until shareholders can actually step up to the plate and say, I'm okay with 3% less of a return or 4% less of a return to take this company into something or give me a social return that I value as much as I value the money.
It's so insignificant that 3%. To whoever, whether you're poor or rich, that 3% means nothing either way. It means nothing on the low end.
But imagine if Cisco could take 3% of their profit resources and devote it to this subject, it could make scalable change.
No, it really could. You're absolutely right. Well, learn more about issues like that we've just been talking about here on the show. We're going to air this also this Sunday again, so people can listen to it on the main course. And to read more and to follow this amazing publication and the ideas of Michelle Nashan, go to foodrepublic.com. Well, thanks so much for being on.
Thank you, Patrick. I really appreciate it.
Anytime.
Great to be here.
And stay tuned for Cooking Issues next, which will start at 12 o'clock.
You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening.